It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, data from the U.S. Census shows that Wisconsin exports dropped by $1 billion last year. A UW economist digs into those numbers and what they mean for the state's economy. First, it's Food Friday. Trying out new recipes is great, but it can be easy to get scared off by the time commitment or the thought of a messy kitchen with lots of cleanup. Our guest this week says there are ways to save time, cut down on that cleanup, and most importantly, have fun while still cooking up something delicious. Yasmin Farr is a food writer whose work has appeared in a number of publications. Her new cookbook is Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. Yasmin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
What got you focused in on, you know, keeping it easy, keeping it simple, and keeping that cleanup down?
So the book is inspired by a recipe column I used to do for Serious Eats. And so it was a one-pot dinner column. And so at the time that I was doing it, I was also a hotel and restaurant inspector. So I was traveling around the world for 2 to 3 weeks of every month. And so when I came home to write the column, I was like, okay, I want to make something that's easy enough to do because I'm super tired, but it's also kind of good for me because I've been traveling and eating out so much. And so that's the same approach I use for the book, because I think even if we're not traveling a lot, we all lead really busy lives but want to make good, delicious food that doesn't take a lot of work or effort. So that's my goal with the book.
And another goal, it's not just the simple, you want to have fun while you cook, and
yeah.
You want us to, too. Can you talk about that fun attitude you try to bring into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think cooking is really fun, and I want to kind of take the stress out of it and the worry. And I think, you know, having a lot of dishes to clean up, having to find recipes that inspire you, that are kind of good for you but interesting, can be difficult. So I really wanted the tone of the book to be exciting, positive, encouraging. So there's lots of little, like, notes in there, essays, kind of talk about my life in food, maybe some embarrassing stories, you know, probably oversharing. But I really wanted to get people excited by it. And, you know, I really love it.
So. You've got a unique piece of kitchen equipment on your list, a hula hoop.
Yeah. So a lot of times when things are, you know, simmering or in the oven, I have a hula hoop that I use just to kind of pass the time. And it's a good way to get some exercise in. And it's really fun. So I want people to do whatever makes them happy during this downtime.
Now, another thing you do is you include something you call kind of efficiency moves in a lot of your recipes to help people save time and to plan on that time saving. What kind of things do you look for?
Yeah, I love that you picked up on that. It's one of my favorite parts about the book. Well, because I think a lot of times home cooks get, when you're making a recipe for the first time, you can be kind of overwhelmed about where to start and what to do. So you'll find tips for what to do during downtime, whether that's cleaning and picking herbs for the garnish, clean up the kitchen, pouring yourself a glass of wine. It's really meant to be a guide for how to approach the recipe to take that kind of anxiety and worry out of it.
Talking to Yasmin Farr, her new book is Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. If you've got a favorite recipe that you can make in just one pan, pot, baking dish, you name it. Yasmin, let's get into some of the recipes you shared with us. We've got them up at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got a meatball one. We'll get into that in a minute. But I want to get into something else. You really like meatballs, if I'm reading your book right.
I do. Yes, I love meatballs. Yeah, I've basically been obsessed with them for a really long time. Like, there's a restaurant in New York, Little Owl, that has these amazing gravy meatball sliders that are super flavorful with this, like, spicy tomato sauce. So basically, there's an essay in the book where I talk about how much I love meatballs and how, you know, I may have overdone it with meatballs at this food. And, yeah, a little embarrassing and probably one of those, like, TMI situations, but really meant,
you know. We appreciate your honesty.
Thank you. I'm now, glad to hear it.
Now, the one you shared with us, this looks great. It's a baked chicken and ricotta meatballs. Can you talk about what goes into this and how it comes together?
Yeah, it's really simple. So for the weeknight, I wanted something a little lighter. So I used chicken and there's ricotta in there. And that really gives kind of like a creamy, light texture to it all. And then you add panko breadcrumbs as well as some like chili flakes and garlic and then parsley. And then you bake it in the oven with broccolini and lemon. And so it's just really bright, but also balanced dish that has some green in it, and you finish it with lemon as well as a little bit extra cheese because, you know, that never hurts. So it's a nice for a weeknight dinner, and all goes on a sheet pan in the oven.
And I'm looking at the picture right now, and it just looks, you know, not complicated, but really pretty with the meatballs and the broccoli together. Do you try to get some visual appeal in there too?
Yeah, I think that always helps. I mean, you know, with this, like, Instagram, we're in a very visual world right now. So I think making food that's beautiful, has a balance of colors and textures, It's a great way for people to feel kind of accomplished on the weeknight. You know, I made this really easy but beautiful dish, so you're kind of winning.
And now I've had good luck making meatballs, like in pan frying them. When I bake them, I don't know, they lose their spherical nature and kind of flip out. Any notions on what I'm doing wrong there? Or if maybe I just need to follow recipes closer. I don't know.
No, I mean, I think, you know, that can happen. And as long as it tastes good, I think that's not a problem.
Okay.
But a lot of times I try to make them smaller than a meatball so they don't, than a golf ball so they don't fall apart. So if you put a little bit of water in your hand and then roll it, but don't make it like super tight, but also packed together and a little smaller than a golf ball for it to cook evenly. So that's usually a good size. Maybe they're too big. Not sure.
That might have been my mistake. Yeah, definitely. I do like the ground chicken in meatballs. And that reminds me, you've got a section up front on substituting proteins. You know, we're making the dish, but we want whatever, chicken instead of beef, tofu instead of chicken, whatever. What do we need to think about, though, when we're subbing in like that?
I think for that, you want to look at the cooking times, how long they take. But as you said, like a lot of in the book, there's little notes of what swap outs will work and then what time to add them in. So, for example, you know, shrimp and fish will need like about 4 minutes to add. But if you're using leftover chicken, really only need a couple of minutes for it to warm up because it's already cooked. But like in the salad for dinner section, you can swap out all those proteins because they all have separate cooking instructions. So I think, you know, if you've eaten like shrimp the night before, you don't want it, you can make a really quick chicken and put it on top of a salad. So
another thing I love about the book, and this is for, and I'm thinking back to my earlier days of cooking, you actually define things like, you know, what a simmer or a boil is, or here, let's do this one, stirring occasionally versus stirring frequently. Because I'm like, those can mean a lot of different things. How do we separate out how often to stir?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of times, like cookbook writers, you know, myself included, use this lingo, and people may not know what it is. And so, for stirring frequently, I say it's about every 30 seconds or so. But you're really standing on top of the pan, you know, with a wooden spoon in hand or whatever you're using. But stirring occasionally, you know, you can step back for a second, check your phone, you know, upload a photo. But it's really stirring every minute or so.
Use the hula hoop.
A little more. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, use your hula hoop, whatever you want.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Russ is with us in Monroe. Russ, hello.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Good. What do you have for us, Russ?
Well, braising meats in wine and stock is like one of the classic one-top meals of all time. If you take a piece of virtually any meat, but beef is always the best, and brown it in a pan, put it in a pot with some wine, some stock, maybe some herbs, you can add any vegetables, and let that go, there's a magical thing that happens when it cooks with the wine. It creates its own gravy, but it changes flavor completely, and is just, in my opinion, one of the greatest meals of all time.
Russ, it sounds awesome. Oh, go ahead, Yasmin.
No, I'm sorry. That was so beautiful. I love the way you describe it. You're 100% right. Yeah.
Do you have any favorite recipes kind of in that neighborhood of a braised meat one-pot meal, Yasmin?
Well, I do some braised chicken breasts like in the soup, but I want everything to be around 30 minutes or less, so nothing is going to be a big cut of meat. Mm. But I do have like a tomato poached cod, which I think may be on your website. And that's really just cooked in kind of like a loose tomato sauce. And so it's cooked really gently. But again, you know, it tastes much more impressive than it actually is. And so it's a really flavorful dish with lots of garlic and herbs. So it's nice.
Yeah, thanks for that call, Russ. We've got that tomato poached cod with herbs at WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm flipping open to the recipe now. Now, you say this is one that looks to the guest more impressive than it was to cook?
Yeah, which I think is always nice because it looks kind of fancy and delicate, you know, and fish. But then it's actually super easy. You don't really have to do a lot. It's one pot. And like Russ was saying, you kind of put everything in there and let the ingredients do the work for you.
Now, this cooks up pretty quickly as fish does. And I got to say, that's my fear of cooking fish is that I'm going to overcook it. How do I make sure I don't overcook the cod, say, in this recipe or my fish in general?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's great about using liquid to cook it is that that won't happen as quickly as it would if you were cooking straight on a pan. So you have it's a little more forgiving, but I would just touch the edges of it. And so once it starts to flake off really easily without resistance, that's the time it's ready.
Fantastic. We're talking to Yasmin Farr, food writer, author of the new book, Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What meals do you make when you want something delicious without sinking a whole night into cooking? What do you do in the kitchen to make things quicker and cut down on cleanup? Do you have a favorite one pot meal that, yeah, I don't want to do a lot of cleanup after I cook. You get it all in one pot or baking dish or whatever. And what's your favorite meatball? If our guest hasn't tried it, she'll want to. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And remember, find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Yasmin Farr, author of the book Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to meal when you want maximum impact for minimal effort? Are there simple dishes you make that impress people you share them with? Do you have some efficiency moves you have that cut down on time and cleanup? And how do you make sure to keep cooking fun? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Kit is with us in Cedarburg. Kit, hello.
Hi. My favorite one-pot meal is you get a corned beef and you put it on in the morning, and then about an hour before you eat, you throw in some red potatoes. Before that, you put in some onions and some celery and carrots. And then you put in cabbage about 20 minutes before. And then I serve it with rye bread and horseradish. It's
fantastic.
Very good.
Kit, I should ask, you're talking about a crock pot here, it sounds like.
No, I just boil it on the stove.
Oh, okay. Oh, in the morning and you're boiling it all day? Okay. So it takes a little more premeditation than that half hour you're looking for, Yasmin. But it sounds like a great use of one pot there.
Yeah, definitely. I love the horseradish and rye. That's great.
Yeah, that's so just because you're making everything in one pot doesn't mean you can't have something fun on the side of it. Do you have, like, favorite, Yasmin, quick little sides or garnishes or things like that you use to jazz up that thing you cooked as a one-pot meal?
Yeah, a lot of them I serve, like a crusty bread, which I think is great. You can put a little olive oil and nice salt on it, especially ones that have sauces like that tomato poached cod. Just to soak everything up with that is so great. Yeah, that's usually what I do.
Kit, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. You've shared one more recipe with us. I want to get to a weeknight curry. And curries, yeah, I think that's something you might want to cook for a really long time. You have this one clocking in at about 20 minutes. How does that pull together so fast?
Yeah, so this recipe is in the chapter Faster Than Delivery. And so in this one, well, actually throughout the book, I use a lot of condiments and paste to really do the work for you. So for this recipe, we use a Thai curry paste. So I used a red one, but you can use green. And it already has like lemongrass, chilies, ginger, and garlic. So we use fresh ginger, garlic to kind of amp up all of those flavors and kind of bring them out. And then you add coconut milk, which is super delicious and creamy, and then just fresh vegetables like snow peas, but there's swap outs like mushrooms or other things if you don't want that. And you finish it with shrimp, and then rice noodles just cook on the side. So you add them in at the very end, and it's this like very quick, very flavorful meal that uses that condiment of a curry paste to do the work for you, which is great.
And I love meals like this where, as you say, it's pretty easy to substitute in vegetables.
Yeah.
When you're doing soups or stews or curries, you don't have X, probably Y is going to work okay.
Exactly. And I think it's one of these things that people can learn this basic technique and then really make it their own. They can, you know, change it up however they want. And I really loved that was kind of the goal of the book, is to give people these tools. Like, you'll learn to do this, and then you can kind of run with it and do whatever you want.
And another thing I love is that you absolve us of any guilt we feel for using some prepared ingredients. We don't have to make our own curry paste.
Yeah.
We can buy a packaged pizza dough, that kind of thing. I've been through points in my cooking life. It's like, no, that's cheating. I got to do everything. And then, you know, kids.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
Exactly.
Shortcuts are great.
Right. And it's like, I think people make really great products now. We're really lucky to be able to buy them. And like, yes, I would love to be grinding my own chilies and making these beautiful curry paste. But like, that's not the reality of my life most of the time. So I think it's totally okay. You do what you have to do to make it work.
Now, do you have, and I have this sometimes, kind of like, you know, a split approach to cooking. There's that weeknight where you want something on the table in under a half an hour. And then, hey, I've got this weekend and somehow there's nothing going on tonight. And then maybe you do something fancier and more time consuming.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I love having people over, like having friends. So making, whether it's like a roast chicken and then a pasta and then a bunch of sides. I think like the weekends are when, like you're saying, you can really kind of luxuriate in the cooking process. Whereas during the weeknight, it's more of a necessity, but you also still want to make it fun and enjoyable and good for you. So I think the book is meant to really cater to that weeknight need.
We are talking to Yasmin Farr. Her new cookbook is called Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. You can join the conversation at 800-642-123 on this edition of Food Friday. If you have a favorite go-to one-pot recipe, something that you make when time is of the essence, something that takes maybe 30 minutes or less, you can call in at 800-642-1234 or get some advice from our guest. Now, if you've got some suggestions, I'm always looking for things like this. When that meal needs something, you know, that one flavor that it's that's going to put it over the edge. What are the kind of things you reach for when it needs that one little something?
Yeah, well, I think that's actually a great question. I think a lot of dishes, when you're tasting at the end, they can feel sort of unbalanced and like something's missing. You're like, but what is it? And I think the go-to people do is usually salt, but actually acid, whether it's like a vinegar or lemon, is really that kind of finishing balancing touch that'll really bring out the flavor. So I would always say, you know, depending on what the dish is, finishing it with some lemon, lime, different vinegars really can help balance it out. And then I would taste it again and then see if it needs more salt or. But I also love using like fresh herbs or things like that to really brighten up a dish and, you know, elevate it. And it makes it feel like a little more alive and green. So I think those things can be really helpful.
Yeah, I've slowly learned over many years like that bit of acid at the end, or as you just said, something green, like a green flavor, if that makes any sense. That's like in second place for me behind an acid for that one last thing to add.
Yeah, and you stir in like spinach because it wilts really quickly, or kale. Like some of those things I think can really just like boost a dish and also give it more substance too. So.
And you are a big fan of feta cheese as a key flavor in your cooking. Talk about why you love that so much.
Yeah, so there's an essay called I Have a Thing for Feta, and I often get called out. Like, if you look at some of my recipes, people are like, if I don't include feta in a dish, they're like, Yasmin, wait, where's the feta? So I definitely am known for this. But yeah, I grew up eating Bulgarian feta, and I think it's just creamy. It has a sort of tang to it, and it's a great way to finish dishes to have that extra texture and like creamy layer without the heaviness of it. And so I actually prefer Bulgarian feta in the brine to Greek feta, which I think is the typical one. And I think a lot of times when you go to supermarkets, you see these Greek fetas and these like cryovac'd packages, and they're kind of cakey and dry. So I think if you can't find Bulgarian, I would definitely look for something in that brine, which is that like cloudy, murky liquid it's sitting in, because that'll keep it really kind of moist and flavorful.
Now, you've got one of the most specific helpful tips at the beginning of the book, how to crumble feta. Talk us through that. How do we get
helpful.
A good feta crumble on?
Yeah, so this is obviously going to come in handy for this book. So I would take a block of feta, and then I take a fork, and I think the way I scribe in the book is kind of like you're clearing rubble from like the ground from the street. So you just kind of move into the block like you're knocking down a building, and then use the fork to kind of crumble it that way. And it's really easy. I mean, you can always use your hands, but I find you still miss sort of chunks, and then it's like massive chunks of feta, which, you know, isn't bad either. But the fork thing really works for me. And I just do it on a cutting board so you can scrape it right in.
Now let's talk for a moment to that that new cook, maybe somebody who's moving out on their own for the first time, setting up their own kitchen. What kind of pots and pans and baking dishes, what are a couple of the key things that you just find yourself going to again and again that you'd recommend that you know, that starter cook definitely has handy?
Yeah, and I really don't think you need a lot. Like in this book, what I recommend, and I think for you know, new cooks as well, you don't need too much. Like I love a cast iron pan just because they're, you know, durable. They're not super expensive if you season them, which honestly isn't as hard as I feel like it sounds. It's really easy. You just don't want to let them sit in water in the sink, but they can be used for so many things. You can also use them in the oven and the stovetop. So they're fantastic. And I do love a Dutch oven, which is a little more expensive, but they are also fantastic and they're beautiful. You can like serve in them. So maybe ask for that as like a wedding gift, holiday present kind of thing. And I love my microplane. So I use that in a ton of things. I like it better than a box grater because the teeth are a little sharper. So you can grate garlic really quickly, ginger, you know, obviously lemon zest, Parmesan. If you want to make like a wintry boozy cocktail, you could do cinnamon or chocolate or nutmeg on top. So they're, again, not very expensive, super helpful and useful in the kitchen. Yeah, and then some wooden spoons, and you really don't need a lot. Oh, and a sheet pan. Sorry, maybe right. A little more than I said. But yeah, sheet pan is really helpful. And there's a whole chapter in the book that's all sheet pan recipes. And those, again, aren't also that expensive. So, and you can store them in your oven, which is what I do.
All right, can you leave us with some inspiration now for the person? And I'm there sometimes. You know, you get home from work and you want to push the super easy button and just call takeout or, you know, peanut butter on an apple or something like that. Give us a little inspiration to maybe try cooking a little something.
Yeah, I mean, we've all been there too. And if you need to do that, like, do that. No judgment. But I would say the like faster than delivery section or making a sheet pan dinner is really wonderful because you basically just heat up the oven. And by the time it's like heated up, you're ready to go. You have all the ingredients on the sheet pan. You just put it in the oven and then you're done. You know, you just wait for it to cook and it's this like wonderful meal. Like I have a roast halibut with lemons and tomatoes and this kind of green herb sauce. And that comes together in 20 minutes. So you've just made this healthy, beautiful, delicious meal with like very minimal effort on your part. So I feel like that's pretty great.
Yasmin, thanks a lot for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yasmin Farah is a food writer, author of the book we've been talking about. It's called Keeping It Simple, Easy Weeknight One-Pot Recipes. You can find a few of those recipes that she shared with us at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got that weeknight curry, baked chicken and ricotta meatballs, and then the tomato poached cod with herbs. All great weekday, or heck, make them on the weekend if you want. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to an economist about recent data that show Wisconsin lost more than $1 billion in exports last year and what that means for the state's economy. By the way, a clarification from yesterday's show. At this time, we talked with State Representatives Jonathan Brostoff and Paul Tittle about mental health care in Wisconsin. Near the end of the conversation, Representative Brostoff said he had written the original draft of Assembly Bill 467, which relates to grants for mental health clubhouses. He later let us know that he misspoke. It was Representative Tittle who had originally drafted that bill. Stick around. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. More to come. Thanks for listening to this edition of Food Friday. Again, check out those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday and let us know how they went for you. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new survey shows that only 40% of Americans have at least $1,000 set aside for an emergency. A financial planner tells us we shouldn't neglect our rainy day funds and tells us how we can become prepared for the unexpected coming up. First, Wisconsin's exports were down by more than $1 billion at the end of 2019. That's according to recent analysis from the Biz Times Milwaukee using data from the U.S. Census Bureau. According to the census, Wisconsin's exports were down to roughly $21.6 billion in 2019. That's down from $22.7 billion in 2018. What's driving these numbers and how do they affect our economy here in the state? Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Menzi, welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure to be here.
Well, looking at these numbers in this way, a $1 billion drop in Wisconsin exports from 2018 to 2019 sounds like a big number. Is it a big deal in the scope of things?
I think it's indicative of a general trend that's probably going to accelerate, even though we think we have some sort of truce in the trade war. And that's because the effects of what sort of retaliation and tariffs have been placed into effect are going to sort of propagate throughout the economy. And so over time, between the tariffs raising costs and the uncertainty that's associated with the policies that are going forward, we're going to see more and more, I think, of this drag on the economy.
Now, on a practical level, if these Wisconsin goods aren't going into other countries, does that mean they're finding other sources for them now? I mean, we hear China maybe going to Brazil for their soy, for example.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, if we look at the total decrease in the trade deficit, it's like $11 billion. And then our trade deficit with China has shrunk $74 billion from 2018 to 2019. Now, what's probably happening is some of that trade deficit is being reallocated to other parts of the world. So exactly, some things are being recategorized. Maybe they said they were coming from China before, now they're coming through Hong Kong. Some activities might be changed to, let's say, Vietnam. Then some things might be you're just changing the labeling and through creative notation on the customs forms.
How much does a decline in our export share from Wisconsin affect the wider economy in the state?
Well, I think it depends a lot on where it's hitting. And so, you can look at the agricultural sector, and that's particularly been hard hit because the Chinese, when they wanted to make our actions painful, they deliberately targeted agriculture where they knew that there was going to be a lot of sensitivity. And you got to remember that even though agricultural prices may not have fallen a lot, like soybeans are like 10 to 15%, what's true is that this has come on the back of already a decline in agricultural prices from like 2016 onwards, 2015, 2016. And so the farm sector is already stressed, so you might say has a disproportionate impact. And then the retaliation has taken place against things like machinery and medical equipment that Wisconsin exports. So that is another place where you'll see disproportionate hits, and you kind of see it in showing up in manufacturing employment, decreasing, actually, whereas in the rest of the country, it's actually increasing, or in the economy as a whole in the nation, it's increasing.
People forget about Wisconsin being a big manufacturing state. Our state is unusually dependent on manufacturing compared to most other states. Do I have that right?
That's right. I mean, it's perhaps not the most dependent, but what's true is these tariffs, so I'm separating out the national security-based tariffs, what are called Section 232 tariffs, from the ones that we've imposed on the Chinese goods. What's true is that the Section 232 tariffs were on aluminum and steel. Well, that helps the producers of aluminum and steel, but we don't have any steel and aluminum production to speak of in Wisconsin. Rather, our medium industry depends upon steel and aluminum. And in point of fact, the way you can think about it is for every job that's in steel production at the basic level, there's about 10 jobs that are dependent in some way. So we are being hit. There's a double whammy. There's a whammy from the fact that steel is more expensive. We put the tariffs on, and to my surprise, essentially the whole tariff has been passed into higher prices for imported goods. And then the retaliation has taken place against our exports. And so if you think about it, our intermediate, the sort of users of steel that export, have been hit by this double whammy.
Talking to Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at a decline last year in Wisconsin's exports and how that fits into the wider story of trade around the world. Well, you referred to this a few moments ago. We have news from China. They say they're cutting a bunch of their retaliatory tariffs in half. But does that take us where we were before the most recent trade dispute? Or are we just lowering the punitive tariffs, but they're still higher than they were at the outset? It gets a little complicated.
Yes, absolutely. The way to think about it is that the phase one deal that was signed essentially decreases the tariffs a little bit from where they were, let's say, several months ago. But definitely these tariffs are much, much, much higher than they were 3 years ago or even 2 years ago. Really, the tariffs were ratcheted up starting in being in effect in July of 2018. And so we are far and away much more tariff-ridden, if I can use that phrase, than we were beginning of 2018. I guess the one thing you can say is we have reduce the uncertainty about tariffs being raised in the near future. So we're taking them down a little bit, and the prospects for more tariffs on the Chinese is eliminated, I think. Now, in the phase one deal, the Chinese are obligated or committed to buying a lot more. Those numbers were pretty implausible to begin with. And now with the impact of the coronavirus, it's even more unlikely. I think the Chinese will be asking for a sort of exemption because of these extreme circumstances.
All that said, though, some of the uncertainty, as you said, is going down. Could that lead to a resumption of more normal trade levels from Wisconsin, from the United States as a whole? Are we going to get back to whatever we want to call normal?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there will be some recovery, but the part of the problem is a lot of the supply chains have been disrupted. Mm. And even in agriculture, you sort of think you can ship and buy soybeans from anywhere. But the fact of the matter is, once the Chinese have started buying more from Brazil and from Argentina, those producers have ramped up production. They have ramped up their capacity to process and move stuff out of their countries. And the Chinese, if they're worried about a future disruption where the Americans, you know, do something else, well, they're going to say, well, why don't I just safeguard myself against that possible disruption and just rely upon other suppliers, and not just in ag, but it could possibly be in other places as well. So once hit, unless there's some big move to eliminate the uncertainty about future potential disruptions, we're not going to get all the way back, except for some sort of trend growth in the world economy. I'll say that's probably far off also because a lot of the trade flows, the amount, depends upon the state of the world economy. And in particular, U.S. economy, it seems to be growing, plodding along. But, you know, the place where you can see forward-looking behavior is in investment. And investment has been declining in the U.S. for the past three quarters. That's not a good signal for future buoyant growth in, as at least perceived by businesses. And, you know, as long as they're not investing, you're going to have a slowdown in trade in intermediate goods, you know, machinery, the stuff that you make things out of.
Now, people might look at something like the job numbers out today, mm-hmm. You know, over a couple hundred thousand jobs added. Not phenomenal, but another month of steady growth that's gone back, what, about 10 years, starting about 2 years after the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. People look at that like, hey, we're doing okay. We've got this steady, sustained growth. Do we need to worry about the impact of these trade issues?
Well, one thing I tell my students is that the employment numbers are all squishy, and not everybody knows that each month you have a estimate, and then the next month that number gets revised. And then once a year, we do a wholesale revision for 2 years going back. Well, we've just seen something on the order of 400,000 jobs. I think if I have my estimates right, you know, just disappear because of revision. We had better data come in, and then the statistical agency said, oh, well, it looks like we're actually on a lower trajectory. And that lower trajectory looks like it starts roughly at the beginning of 2019. And it's hard to say for sure, but I would say that part of that lower trajectory is, well, we're near full employment, but also the uncertainty that and decreased momentum we have because of the trade wars.
Looking at this again from the perspective of Wisconsin, I talked to a Wisconsin trade policy person earlier this week. How much control does a state have over how it fares on the world export market? Or are we just kind of dependent on what's going on around the world?
We're at the whims of other forces, other big forces. I mean, for sure, you know, what retaliation is placed upon Wisconsin's exports, particularly ag, but also machinery. That's their decision, which is in response to what the Trump administration does. Another big determinant is just, you know, how well the rest of the world economy is doing. Well, we export some amount to China. And, you know, some of it's ag and some of it's going to be depressed because of decreased demand. So, you know, that's a big factor. Finally, you know, the value of the dollar is another factor. That's certainly not in the hands of any one particular agency. So all these things are going to go into the determination of how well we do in terms of Wisconsin exports.
Menzie, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
My pleasure.
Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us today to talk about the impact that trade policies and tariffs had on Wisconsin's exports in 2019. We saw about $1 billion drop between 2018 and 2019 in exports from the state. You can find a link to the Milwaukee Biz Journal's analysis of that export data at WPR.org/centraltime. Coming up, we'll talk about how to build up our personal emergency fund and why so many people have trouble doing it, according to new surveys. A lot of people, most people, don't have enough for a $1,000 emergency expenditure. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a task force at UW-Eau Claire is out with recommendations following incidents of racist behavior from students last year. We'll find out what they're urging the university to do in our state news roundup. Now, a new survey shows that most Americans don't have much of a rainy day fund. According to Bankrate, only 41% would be able to cover a $1,000 car repair or emergency room visit using savings. For those unable to foot that bill, 37% said they'd have to borrow money in some form. In addition, 28% of respondents said they or a close relative paid for a major unanticipated expense in the past year. The average cost of that, more than $3,500. So why are Americans struggling with saving, and how can we beef up our own emergency fund? Chris Hogan is a personal finance expert in Nashville and host of The Chris Hogan Show. He's also the author of Everyday Millionaires, How Ordinary People Built Extraordinary Wealth, and How You Can Too. Chris, good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We have this report. So many people don't have that $1,000 cushion for an emergency. Is this a surprise to you at all?
It really isn't, because recent studies have shown that you've got almost 80% of people that are living paycheck to paycheck. And what that means is that if they ever have one check that doesn't show up, they have what's called a situation. So people in America are up to their eyeballs in debt, and what they need is a way out to understand how to have some cushion between them and life. And so it's really important for people to understand you've got to have some money that you can grab when life happens unexpectedly.
We'll talk about how to develop that cushion in a minute, but let's talk about the urgency a little more. It's not hard to rack up $1,000-ish in a car repair, a health bill, a home repair, that kind of thing. This is something that can happen real easy, right?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head with a vehicle or a transmission issue. You have some issues with tires. I mean, getting to $1,000 is not hard. And so looking at this, it really shows how imperative it is that people wake up and shake up what they're doing so they can make some changes.
Now, for people with credit, they might say, no big deal. I'll put it on a credit card, pay it off over time, no problem. What do you say to them?
Boy, I'm going to tell you something. That 98% of people out there have had that problem or are having it. And that's a dangerous thing. You know, to give people a PhD in economics, I tell people this. Interest that you pay is a penalty. And anytime you use someone else's money, they charge you the penalty called interest. But then again, interest that you earn is a reward. And so I think we need to stop being penalized in our lives and put ourselves in a position to be rewarded. That debt is a threat. It steals from you right now, but it also steals from your future. And I need people to wake up and see it for what it is. Don't think that credit card is your friend. It's an enemy with handcuffs.
Chris, people might say, yeah, this all sounds great, but, you know, by the time I add up my rent or mortgage, my food, my gas bills, whatever, there's nothing left to save.
Well, I've been there, and I have experienced it, and I felt that same way. But when I started to dig in and understand the difference between needs and wants, I was able to really make grown-up decisions. And what you need is to take care of your shelter. You need food. You got to have your vehicle, and you got to have clothing. But what we don't need is to go out to eat five nights a week. We don't need the fancy cable stations. We don't need those things. So I would just encourage people to really look at it and understand you are working hard. You are trying to provide for yourself and your family. What I want to do is give you an opportunity to work a plan that not only lets you continue to work hard, but it helps you to work smarter. And then working smarter allows you to make progress.
Now, you recently wrote a piece where you gave some suggestions, kind of a multi-step plan, and step one is build that emergency fund first. How can we make sure we're prioritizing that before we move on to other wants and needs?
Well, I think it's important to have that emergency fund because we've all had life sneak up on us. I had to do a car repair not long ago, and it was a starter, and that starter was $650. And so understanding that life is going to happen means that I want to be able to reach for cash, not credit. And so understanding that I want you to be prepared. I want you to have that cushion between you and life happening. And that's what that $1,000 is. And so how do you go about that? Well, I think we've got more stuff in our closets and in our garages for us to go around and make a list of things that you could sell. Put a dollar amount outside of that. And as you sell those things, that's the beginning of your emergency fund. And then take a look at your budget. Look at the non-essential things that you're spending on, like it's eating out or gifts or clothing or stuff that we buy for ourselves. Let's scale that back and begin to put some dollar amounts and be more intentional with our money. So selling some stuff, being intentional with your budget, you can get to that $1,000 saved.
We're talking to personal finance expert Chris Hogan, author of the book Everyday Millionaires, looking at a new study that says a lot of Americans don't have money set aside for a financial emergency, not even $1,000 set aside for that emergency car bill, health bill, you name it. Chris, when we're setting aside this money, is it okay to just kind of mentally know it's in the checking account, so the same as the rest of our money, or should we isolate it somehow?
I think it's absolutely imperative to isolate that money. I think it's important to pull that money aside and put it in a money market account. A money market account is going to give you a better rate of savings than a typical savings account. But if you choose a savings account, use that. What I found was this with myself. When I left extra money in my checking account, there's a name for it, and it was called spent. And so I want people to prevent that. And it's not enough to know it's there mentally. We need to tangibly be able to look at a statement or pull it up on our mobile devices and look and see and know that we have it there.
You've been talking about debt a little bit, too, here. Now, that's a separate issue in some ways from the emergency fund. How do we start to prioritize paying down our various debts? How do we start to do that once we've got that emergency fund, at least, you know, on the way?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that when you get out of debt, you give yourself a raise. I mean, let's think about that. You don't have to go talk to your employer. You don't have to go talk to your leader or your boss. You can give yourself a raise. And so to prioritize that, I encourage people to list your debts out smallest to biggest. I don't care about interest rate. We're going to focus on the size of the debt. And I want you to make minimum payments on everything else while you throw all extra money at that smallest debt. I have found throughout the 20 plus years of doing this money stuff that when you attack debt, it's about momentum, not math. And when you pay off that little one, you start to believe that you can do this. And the next thing you know, you stay focused and you can continue doing it and you give yourself a raise.
I've read some of your work. You're not saying, hey, everyone live, you know, in a shack, eating only gruel and deny yourself all the pleasures in life. But you say if you're looking for that big thing, the trip, say, plan it out in advance. Don't get caught by surprise by how much it costs when you get there. How do we do that?
That's exactly right. And I think anytime, I don't have a problem with people doing things or having nice stuff. Once you get yourself out of debt, I want you to have fun, but I do want you to plan for it. And so that comes back to the budget of intentionally setting money aside, whether it's for that vacation. How much are you going to set aside per month for that? Or are you going to work an extra job to bring in the funds to be able to do that? I just want people to use cash. I want you to come back from a vacation with some souvenirs, not a credit card statement.
How about retirement savings? For a lot of people, especially, you know, facing that debt, worried about that emergency hit to their daily budget, retirement can feel a long way away. How do we start to put a dent in that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is understanding that retirement's not an age, it's a financial number. And in my first book, Retire Inspired, that was America's wake-up call to start to see retirement as an opportunity. But I think when you get yourself out of debt and you start to really build up your fully funded emergency fund of 3 to 6 months of your expenses, so that would be adding up what does it take for you to live on, and I want you to save up 3 to 6 months of that in that money market account. Now you've got a bigger cushion for yourself, even in retirement or as life is happening. And so it's a long way off, but we got to start sooner than later because compound interest is our best friend. It helps money to grow.
I want to talk to you about kind of a, I guess it's more of a psychological issue. I've heard from experts and callers over the years that some people don't even want to start thinking about this. They're scared if they look at their financial situation that it's going to be worse than they think. So there's just kind of a denial out there. How can people get over that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is to understand where you are right now is not where you have to end up. And the only way for us to get better is to engage things. And it's impossible to manage anything you're not aware of. So take the courage and take that first step. Sit down and write down your expenses. Take a look at how much money you're bringing in. Write down your debts and really look at this and make a decision. Are the people in your home, do you love them enough that you want better for them? And I've never met a parent or a grandparent that didn't want their kid or grandkids to have better. Well, the only way we can do that is to work a plan that actually works. And we've helped over 6 million families throughout the years to really get out of debt and be able to build wealth. And I know they can do it because I did it myself.
Chris, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Hogan is a personal finance expert and host of The Chris Hogan Show. He's the author of Everyday Millionaires, How Ordinary People Built Extraordinary Wealth, and How You Can Too. We talked with him today about American struggles with savings and how we can build up our rainy day funds after a recent survey showed that most Americans don't have enough cash on hand for a $1,000 emergency expenditure. Coming up next week, we've invited all four candidates for the 7th Congressional District to join us here on Central Time. This would fill the seat vacated by Representative Sean Duffy. The primary in that race will be held on Tuesday, February 18th. There are two Democrats and two Republicans who will appear on that ballot. We want to know what questions you want us to ask the candidates and what issues are most important to you. Send us an email at centraltime@wpr.org and let us know where you're emailing from. Again, that's centraltime@wpr.org with your questions for the 7th District Congressional Seat candidates in this spring's special election. Sunday is National Pizza Day for some reason. In honor of the random occasion, here are two pieces of pizza news. One, the official Twitter account of the state of New Jersey announced the following, quoting, "This Sunday, in honor of National Pizza Day, we will be declaring," all caps now, "New Jersey, the pizza capital of the world. Get ready." This has started arguments with places like New York City, Italy, and just about everywhere. I got to say, I do like the New Jersey Twitter account. A lot of sass there. I can't judge New Jersey pizza. I've only been in New Jersey for part of a day, and I did not sample the pizza there. I hear good things. I did go to that the Cake Boss Bakery there and got a cannoli, and it was a really good cannoli. So if that's an indicator of pizza quality, I guess they've got my vote. Now, the other piece of pizza news, according to federal data about emergency room admissions, the number of pizza-related injuries jumped quite a bit from 2017 to 2018. That's the most recent data available. Causes include cuts while pizza rolling, cheese burn, you don't want that cheese burn, falling while carrying a pizza, and at least one case of swallowing someone's tongue ring, while, I guess their own tongue ring, probably, while eating pizza. So if you're enjoying a pizza, a hot pizza on National Pizza Day on Sunday, let's be careful out there. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.